we made a lot of millionaires. It's insane, you know, sort of like, you know, the Belichickian, if you look at the branches of, you know, Belichick and all the coaches, but the number of people that, the number of people that were sort of early adopters of Discovery Cracker that became eDiscovery processing companies, the amount of money they made in that service and then ultimately selling their companies, it's insane.
Everyone, this is The DAP File, a podcast that explores the ideas, opinions, and backstories of the people shaping the world of electronic discovery. I'm Brandon Law, the founder and CEO of Oasis and the host of this here podcast. On the show today, I talk with Rick Weber. So Rick is a lawyer, a business advisor. He's an entrepreneur. He's a lot of things. He goes way back to the beginning of eDiscovery. He was there and he was involved in the creation of what I consider the first eDiscovery software, which was Discovery Cracker. He ended up selling that to Doculex. He's built and managed service companies like Elijah. He's an expert in cybersecurity. I think one of the most interesting things he's done is what he's doing now, which is his role at Arbor Ridge. And that's really what we spend probably the second half of the conversation really talking about. Really the business of eDiscovery. We go into great length about everything from EBITDA and multiples to, you know, all the different valuations, really the ins and outs and the behind the scenes of how these companies, these eDiscovery companies, are worth so much money. But first, start at the beginning, like always. Rick, how'd you get into the industry?
Accidentally, I would say.
Like so most of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I guess it's a good story. So I started as a lawyer in 94 at Mayer Brown in Chicago, litigation department. I knew literally before I even started, having been a summer associate at Mayer Brown, that I was not going to be in for the long haul. And as a summer associate, I kind of saw that three-year mark was like, you get kind of like a three-year free pass, and then it was sort of, you kind of had to really crank it up if you wanted to try to stay and make partner and all that stuff. So I kind of knew going in that, okay, I'll be here for about 3-4 years. After that, I left. I became a prosecutor for the Securities and Exchange Commission here at Chicago. That was a great job. I absolutely loved that job. Kind of similarly, when you go to the SEC or into the government, you either stay there for like 3 to 5 years and kind of hone a very specific skill and then leave, or you become a lifer. And I didn't want to be a lifer at the government. So I knew I was going to be there probably about 3 to 5 years. So after about the 3-year mark, I was trying to figure out what my next move was. And the most logical step was to basically go back to a law firm and become a securities litigator and kind of go in as either of counsel or a partner. And that was for sure the most logical step. But the problem is I don't want to go back to a law firm. Yeah. So then it was, you know, this was 1999. And I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I sort of vividly remember I was at a continuing legal education seminar here in the Chicago Bar Association. It was kind of boring. So I pulled out a bunch of pieces of paper and just started making lists of like things that I liked, what I liked, what I didn't like, you know, just professionally. And sort of at the end of this exercise, it kind of spelled out that, you know, some management consulting. So I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to be in management consulting. And this is around the time when McKinsey and Bain and all the big management consulting firms were starting to hire lawyers, not just MBAs. So I kind of walked out of that seminar thinking, okay, I'm going to go into management consulting. So a good friend of mine, who for lack of a better word, was a legal technologist by the name of Jay Lieb, who's very well known in the eDiscovery
also been
business
on the podcast.
Space. So, well, that's good. So Jay and I were good friends. And we were getting drunk over tequilas on a Thursday night, ready to go out for, you know, the big Thursday night. And I told him I was going to leave the SEC and go into management consulting. And, you know, in that conversation, it was, you know, if you're going to go into consulting, why don't we just do our own thing?
Yeah. Consult me.
Yeah. So it was a Thursday night. And I said, you know, let me think about it over the weekend. And I was young and single and no debt, no kids, no wife. And I remember thinking to myself that, like, if I'm ever going to do something, like leave my job and make no money, now's the time. And I'd rather try and fail than not try and regret. And I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I'm like, you know, sort of this is my time to really give it a shot.
Yeah.
So I gave my notice that Monday that I was leaving the SEC. Jay and I decided we'd start a company, and we started a company called Advocate Solutions. We used to joke that I was the advocate and he was the solution. And we would sit with lawyers and the IT guys and bridge that communication gap. And, you know, this is 2000. That problem still exists today, but it's, you know, what lawyers need and what they do in their profession is a language that's completely different than what IT does and what IT needs. And it's just still hard to sort of get them communicating on the same page. So we would sit with these lawyers and the IT guys and consult with them, and we would bring in the best third-party software products like Summation or Concordance. Jay would do some of that training. I had some consulting work that I was able to do to bring in a little bit of money. And along that process, we had two things happened. We were officing out of Bound Business Solutions at the time. That was a big Reaper graphics company. And this was during the Microsoft litigation, and they were printing out Microsoft emails and then scanning, coding, and OCRing them back into the computer. And we saw that process, and it made no sense that they were taking something that was digital, turning it to analog, and then taking it back to digital again. And we also had a client that called us up and said, hey, you sold us Concordance and you trained us on it, but we have 10 gigabytes of Lotus Notes data that we need to get into Concordance. Can you help us? And when you're a startup, the answer to every question like that is absolutely, for sure we can do it.
No problem.
I don't know exactly what Jay had to do with the help of another guy to get that data into Concordance, but it was a hell of a mess. But between those two things, sort of the light bulb went off, and it was, this is the next big wave. Now, it sounds silly now, this is 2000. And, you know, again, people were printing out e-files, scanning, coding, and OCR. Sure. It was like $1.25, $1.50 a pop. And it was like going around the block to go next door because it was digital and you wanted it to stay digital. So we kind of whiteboarded and sketched out this idea of what if we could take these emails and electronic files and convert them to a TIFF image natively and pull out the text, populate a database, and suck out the metadata, which people didn't even know what that was, but that was becoming a big thing in the Microsoft case about access to documents and when documents were opened and modified and things like that. And we kind of like sketched this whole thing out. I was like, oh, this could be pretty cool. So Jay says, you know, we need a developer. So we found a developer, and the idea was we'll pay this guy for about a month to develop this product. It'll be built, and then we'll go out and sell it as a service. So that was the naivete at the time. That would take a month.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. It took us 5 minutes to sketch it on the board, so it's only going to take a month to develop it. So one developer who, you know, we couldn't get rid of became two developers and so on. And so we developed this product. We called it, we were calling it Outlook Cracker. It was Outlook Cracker.
They probably didn't like that.
Well, it was internal. We were just...
I see.
And we used to like talking about cracking emails and this, that, and the other thing. So we started selling this as a service. We basically went to all of our law firms that had sold Summation and Concordance to and said, look, you know, we can get emails into the same system a lot faster by going through this process than printing, scanning, OCRing. So we had a little bit of traction. And one day Jay says to me, you know, someday someone's going to shrink wrap a solution like this, and instead of like a couple of competitors, we're gonna have thousands of competitors. And unless we, you know, hire a bunch of salespeople, we're gonna be out of business. And I said, if someone's gonna shrink wrap this and put our service business out of business, why don't we shrink wrap this and put our business out of business?
Right.
And he liked the idea. So we basically hired more programmers, got rid of our sales guys, and really just aggressively doubled down on the technology and the software. We rebranded it to Discovery Cracker. And this was 2001-ish. We had one client that somehow found us on the Yahoo blog, we found him or he found us and corresponded, yeah, we can solve this problem. And this is back in the day where, you know, we didn't even have an installation package for the software. So Jay would have to like fly down on site with computers and the software and like loading it and literally building a Discovery Cracker system mm-hmm. on site. This guy blogged or posted a blog about us, and he said, it's magic in a box. And that was it. We exploded from that. Like enough people saw that. We got, I think the next day, like 20 emails from people. Hey, I saw the blog. We had the same problem. Can you help us? So wow. Discovery Cracker really was born pretty much by that. You know, and then it was.
Did you have any competitors early on?
Case Central, Fios, and was it EDD? EED?
EED.
Yeah, EED.
Yeah.
They were competitors.
But they weren't selling software.
That's it. They weren't selling software. Stuff. It was, give us your emails, we'll host them.
I don't remember a competitor coming in for you guys until those guys out of the Pacific Northwest.
Pack Legal?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were kind of around.
And Discover E.
Discover, yeah. So it was Discover E and then also Zprint.
And Zprint, yeah.
But Zprint really wasn't a competitor either. That was...
It was just a better way to print stuff out so you could scan it back in.
Exactly. which ultimately Zprint became kind of a Discovery Cracker product. But, right. But Discovery Cracker was really the first product to do what it did. And it was taking native emails and electronic files and processing them and pumping them into summation and concordance into your own firewall rather than having it being hosted.
Print drivers that pushed out TIFFs instead of pieces of paper.
Yeah.
That's when the industry started for me. I was running a little scan shop. I came in a little bit later. I was probably Cracker version 4. I remember when 5 came out.
That was
so it was like 4.3 or something. And I was running this little scan shop. And it was a nightmare. And one day, a red computer, I remember it clear as day. It was enormous. It was red and it sat under my desk. And the sales guy came in and was like, hey, this is what we're doing now. This is called a cracker box. What we do is instead of printing out all this stuff anymore, we're going to do electronic stuff. And I was like, all right. Our first client was this guy named Greg Chan. He's still around. And he gave us a 1 gig file. I had 1 gig and
we, $10,000.
And it was a proof of concept, right? He's like, if you can get through this 1 gig, you can have my business. So I get 1 gig of data. It's a 1 PST and Cracker. Never seen it, never heard of it, nothing like that. And we had to deliver a DAT file because obviously it was going into concordance. And it took me about 4 days to get through all of that. And it was a nightmare. We didn't get the project, obviously. We obviously didn't know what we were doing. But yeah, that's kind of when it all started, yeah. I think, for a lot of us. Like the real old timers that were around there at the beginning.
We made a lot of millionaires.
You sure did.
It's insane. You know, sort of like, you know, the Belichickian, if you look at the branches of, you know, Belichick and all the coaches, but the number of people that were sort of early adopters of Discovery Cracker that became e-discovery processing companies, the amount of money they made in that service and then ultimately selling their companies, it's insane.
Well, you made a lot of millionaires, but you also made a lot of $100,000 errors too. You know what I mean? I mean, I was part of that group. I didn't own that company, but I went from being, you know, $19 an hour to $25,000 a year to $50,000 to $80,000 to $110,000. That was just on Cracker.
Yeah.
You know, because I was the only guy who could really start to do this stuff. And we failed more than we won back then. But yeah, it built careers. It built a lot of stuff.
Well, you make an interesting point, because if you look at the salaries of the sales reps back in 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, when we started Discover Cracker, we were charging 25 cents a page.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know what that would translate into a gig. But then it was, you know, then gig pricing came in maybe 2005, 6, 7 range. But you're talking $3,000-$4,000 a gig. And I mean, the amount of money that was coming in, that the salaries of these people for this industry compared to other industries was insane.
Yeah.
You couldn't get a sales guy for under $100,000, if not a quarter of a million for some of these guys.
But what that allowed everybody to do, since all of a sudden there was tons of money in the market, is it allowed us to all invest in our businesses.
Yeah.
Right? We had extra money so we could hire, kind of level everybody up, because a lot of those companies were running like basically sweatshops. I mean, mine was. It was a very low margin, very commoditized industry. but we had relationships with all these law firms. You know, there was this big problem that we could solve, and all of a sudden we had a bunch of money because they were giving us, you know, $1,200 a gig or $2,000 a gig for this stuff. And even before that, like you said, per page.
Yeah.
And we invested it in servers and we invested it in talent, and everything kind of got leveled up and built the foundation for what, you know, that service provider market was going to end up maturing into.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So fasting forward a little bit. So this was 2002. You know, those were some really intense years. I mean, obviously anyone, I think anybody in a startup knows what those first two years are like. And at that point, people knew who we were. And we had a number of groups approach us about buying us. And I think Jay and I were just exhausted, truthfully. And Doculix gave us an offer that made sense for us at the time. You know, in hindsight, we sold the company way too early.
Jay says the same thing.
Way too early. Yeah. So this is, and I hope he's listening, but when your business partner is a visionary, it's hard to know how far into the future the prediction is. So in 2002, Jay came to me and said, the TIF is dead. We need to think about selling Cracker to another group. So I think Jay was right. The TIF is dead. It just took 10 to 15 years for him to be right. But, you know, so I'm thinking, oh my God, the TIF is going to die. Let's sell this thing. So that was sort of an impetus to maybe sell. We also actually had an idea for a product called FastView, which we had completely spec'd out, which is basically what Relativity became.
Native file viewer?
Yeah, with taxonomies and analytics. And again, brilliant guy, way ahead of his time. But we were exhausted and still scrappy. And it was just, I think we were looking.
And after going through that, like, trauma of the first 2 years, I went through this as well. Like, you, every day could be your last day. You know, every month could be the month you don't make payroll. And you go through that, and then someone comes and says, I'll give you $10 million. And you're like, done.
Yeah.
Done. No. Like, I don't have the endurance anymore.
It's the emotions that you go through in a startup on a daily basis. It's 1 minute you're a millionaire and 1 minute you're going out of business and everything in between. And it can just change throughout the day. So we sold to Doculix in 2003, I stayed on with them for 3 years as part of that deal. And then I kind of had my daughter was born, my father had a heart attack, and I took 6 months off to try to figure out what I wanted to do. I had spent 6 months, as a lawyer. I'm sorry, 6 years as a hardcore attorney, 6 years as a hardcore business guy, entrepreneur. I had to kind of decide whether I want to go back into law or go work for someone or anyways, long story short, someone I had known in the industry, called me up. He had started an e-discovery company out of Texas called eDirect Impact, a guy by the name of Sammy Rahman. And he called me up and said, look, I'm developing this project management technology. You know software. You also know business. I have no clue what I'm doing. I'm in debt. Would you like to come be my business partner and take on, you know, I'll give you a big chunk of the company in exchange for sweat equity. You know, who wouldn't want that offer, right?
Yeah, right.
I'm in debt. I can't pay you, but I can give you stock in a company that's actually in the red. You want in? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
You're nuts.
So he was in Texas. I was in Chicago. I knew I was probably going to be moving at the time. So got involved with him. We had a really amazing run for a year and a half, got out of debt. Everyone got on the payroll, doing really well. There was a personal situation that he had. I won't go into it here, but he had a life-altering change with a child that was born at 26 weeks. And that the timing couldn't have been worse, because that literally happened right at the beginning of the economic meltdown. Mm. So between him just being completely mentally disassociated from the business, rightfully so, and the economy, we decided at that point, even though we were on this great growth curve, that it just made sense to maybe combine forces with another group. So we sold 51% of that company to a Texas-based company. Long story short there, it just wasn't a great fit, so the integration was moving slowly. The personalities were fine, it's just the businesses didn't fit well for various reasons. They also, ironically, were in negotiations to get bought out. And they did. They got bought out in 2012 before we had been fully integrated. So at that point, I got the company back. My business partner, Sammy, was out. It was me and it really was just me and one other person. So I went from, like, I had a my shares of this company went up, they went down, they went up. So I ended up getting the company back in 2012 and merged it with a company here in Chicago called Elijah, Computer Forensics Company. The CEO and founder of Elijah was a good friend of mine. He and I were actually summer associates together at Mayor Brown. Very close friends. And it just made sense. You know, he was doing computer forensics, a little bit of hosting, but we were really heavy in the hosting with project management technology that could sort of sit on top of everything. And that was 2013. That merger worked out great. As both the forensic business unit grew and the e-discovery business unit grew, we really saw that those two businesses as businesses don't fit. Computer forensics it's basically a law firm or a consulting firm. We charge by the hour and we provide a very highly specialized skill. And it's project-based. Obviously, e-discovery, it's hosting, it's a technology business. You know, you throw computers at it, it's a gigabyte business. And there was very little to no crossover between the e-discovery folks and the computer forensics folks. So at that point in time, we talked, and my business partner's passion really is computer forensics. I don't know how deep you want to get into my thoughts about the industry, but I thought for us at the time, it made sense to get out of e-discovery and sort of let everybody else fight over per gigabyte pricing and, you know, relativity deployments. And
so you saw in 2013, 14 that you wanted to be in the forensics business and the e-discovery business was not going in the direction you wanted it to be, or?
No, I think in 2016, two things. As the overall business was growing, we saw the glaring division between the two different businesses that we were running, and they fit in perfectly on the EDRM model. You know, you get the data early, you harvest it, or you do forensic analysis, sure. And then you just pump it through a hosting engine. That all makes sense. But there's a clear handoff between the computer forensic guys and the e-discovery guys. And again, they're just very different businesses. So we made the decision, hey, if we have an opportunity to break apart this business and keep the forensics and sell off the e-discovery, that might be an interesting opportunity.
Got it.
And that's basically what we did. So in 2017, we sold off the e-discovery business unit and maintained the computer forensics business. And we're a pure play computer forensics company and adding things like data security, penetration testing, vulnerability assessments. We're doing M&A cybersecurity due diligence. We're trying to get a little more away from, not more away from, but we're trying to be more inclusive of non-litigation technology solutions and services associated around the computer forensics skill set that our team has.
I hear breach is a big hot spot right now. Does that kind of fit into the cyber, to that world, or is that more in your mind like the e-discovery skill set?
No. So again, the e-discovery skill set is e-discovery skill set. The computer forensics skill set is the computer forensics skill set. So we're, as a computer forensics company, we now get a lot of phone calls about it for incident response. So yeah. There's an incident, someone clicked on an email they shouldn't have, or someone detects that there was maybe an intrusion. We need to figure out what happened. So that's really our computer forensics folks going in and doing a forensic analysis to figure out the second someone clicked on this email, what then happened?
Yeah.
So we can then do that forensic analysis and figure out what happened. And then there's the remediation. So it's, you know, how did it happen? What happened after it happened? And then how do you fix it? So I think there's kind of three distinct parts to that. And, you know, our skill set is really what happened once they clicked it. We can get involved in some remediation, and as well as, you know, how do you prevent this from happening in the future? So that's kind of where the business currently is going. You know, I'm the only guy in the company who doesn't do the work. So with that, I had managed the due diligence process for this deal, and that was my fourth deal. And I was managing the discovery business, and that was gone. So earlier this year, in a conversation with my business partner, it was, you know, we've done a lot of deals. We're lawyers. Like, we understand this industry. There's so much consolidation going on. We can take lessons learned from everything that we've done to this point and help other companies that are looking for an exit maximize their outcome, and bigger companies looking to grow through acquisition find great targets. And sort of with that idea, it happened at Legal Tech this year. We were having coffee, and it just sort of came to me, and It's just one of those ideas that just wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
And the more we thought about it, it's like, it was just, this is a perfect idea for us. I mean, we just are perfectly tailored for, you know, we're not going to give legal advice, but we can help our clients, you know, maybe make a better deal for themselves from the legal experience. Plus we've done deals. We know how to structure them.
And you've seen both sides, right? Like, exactly. You know, from the buy side, what that's like and what the whole process is, whether it's someone's first time or it's their fourth time, they still want someone who's been through it. But then on the buy side, you know, folks that want to get into this space that might not necessarily have that refined taste to know the difference between a winner and a loser, they need someone to help kind of be their guide.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about, yeah, earlier this year when you're looking at it and you said there's a lot of M&A in this space. It feels to me like 2015 started, 16 and 17 was super hot. And then kind of with like the end, it feels to me like the pace dropped off after the big mergers went through, you know, Kroll and L Discovery at the end, and then DTI and Epic at the end. And that to me sort of felt like all the small companies had been rolling up and rolling up and rolling up and rolling up. Advanced Discovery and Consilio maybe being the third kind of big one.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder now, well, first of all, is that also how you see it? And moreover, like, how do you see the space now? Is there still a lot of opportunities? Is there still a lot of activity? Or has the M&A pace really dropped off?
No, I think the M&A pace is still very strong. I think what we're seeing based on, so you're exactly right. I mean, the roll-ups were such that there's there's still a lot of under $10 million e-discovery companies out there. And there's still a lot of over $100 million companies out there with the big roll-ups. There's not a lot of 25 to 75 or even 20 to $50 million e-discovery companies. They've kind of disappeared.
Right. I call them the middle class.
Yeah, the middle class is gone. So I guess ironically, it sort of resembles maybe what's happening, you know, beyond e-discovery.
The
but
rich get richer, and then there's the 1%
and the rest. Yeah, there's no middle class anymore. There's some, but they're very hard to find. And they're
the types of companies that have withstood 25 offers already, right? Like there's a reason they haven't sold. Right,
like, but even some of them have succumbed. Like iPro, perfect example. You know, the original owners forever. I don't know what their revenues were, but medium sized company, impervious to being bought out. I mean, you would have thought they would have been bought out 10 years ago, and they didn't. And lo and behold, they got bought out by a private equity group a couple of years ago. And so the middle class is gone, but yeah. There are still a very large number or a decent supply of good under $10 million companies doing
service side companies or software companies.
Well, there's a lot of startups. There's a lot more tech startups today, certainly than, I mean, you know, there were no tech startups when we started Discovery Crocker.
Exactly.
It was Summation Concordance, and then sort of we came along. You know, iConnect came along. There were a couple, you know, whatever. There were some, but now it's. I mean, you don't even know who these companies are, and it's like, oh, you're doing well. Yeah, aren't you doing the same? So. Globally, I think you're just seeing a lot of more technology development, and you're seeing that now in our space. So there's definitely a lot of startup technologies, and a lot of these companies just aren't going to make it. And whether they have good tech or not, I guess will dictate whether they're going to end up in good hands. So, you know, we talk to a lot of these groups that it's kind of the same thing. You know, we had this idea for tech, we've developed it, it's great, but to get it to market, there's so much noise, we're struggling, we don't have a budget to hire 20 salespeople and 20 marketing people. You know, what do we do? So then it's, you know, maybe try to find them a good home, or maybe it becomes a technology play and the key people go on board. And a lot of these bigger companies are just getting stronger because now they're buying good tech and a couple of really good key people at a dollar amount that's, you know, pretty good deal for them. You know, it oftentimes just comes down to a sort of a buy versus a build analysis by the companies as to whether this is technology they want, and if they do they want to buy it or do they want to build it, and time to market and so on. So there's definitely a lot of small startup technologies that I think are going to disappear. I think there's some that might make it, a few will make it in each sector, you know, not a few total, but you know, of the new sort of CS Discos and Everlaws and Logicals. I mean, I don't believe all of them are going to survive. I think a couple will emerge as strong companies. Maybe they will. But I think some will disappear. But those groups are getting heavily VC backed, so I don't put them in those categories. I'm talking about the companies that you sort of never heard of, that are self funded, or maybe they got friends and family round of $500,000 or $1 million, and now all of a sudden.
But there does seem to be a difference, right, between like the service provider roll up model, which is mostly, you know, like you build the service business, you have recurring revenue. It's more like EBITDA and multiple. And that's the kind of private equity that we've seen, that M&A that's rolled up everything into Epic, et cetera, et cetera. On the technology side with the VC and getting like Everlaw getting funding, a lot of people are getting funding right now. It seems like that's and I don't quite know the difference. Like it seems like the technology side businesses, the software type companies, they don't have the revenue yet. Like they're selling IP. They're not necessarily selling, you know, we did, you know, $17 million in profit last year. They did none. And like they have two customers and that's what they're selling. It seems like a very different play in terms of who's interested in what type of e-discovery company. And I'm making the distinction there because a lot of folks kind of conflate the two, that an e-discovery software company has the same sort of opportunities or the same types of investment or investors as the service side business.
So
am I onto something there?
Absolutely. So look, I think you've drawn two distinctions between private equity and venture capital, and a line between technology and services. So I tell people that venture capitalists buy dreams. Private equity buys reality. And it's a completely different conversation. It's a completely different analysis. And when you're talking to a venture capital, it's here's what we're building, here's why it's disruptive, and here's how many zeros we're going to make for our investors in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And they're mostly pre-revenue. And in fact, they're losing a ton of money. And if you looked at that as a business, it's you're losing money, you're going to go out of business, you have no customers. So private equity is sort of this like cold dose of reality of EBITDA. What is your bottom line? What's your profitability? They have a formula. It's, you know, net earnings times a multiple equals a purchase price.
Yep.
And if there are no earnings, to try to get a private equity group to say the value of this technology is X, they really wrestle with that conversation because private equity guys don't think that way. They have shareholders and limited investors who invested in the idea that we're going to buy a company that's doing a certain amount of revenue. You're going to throw a little bit of gasoline on it, or maybe add the right people, or get rid of the wrong people.
Find some other companies, roll it up with some other stuff already.
Roll it up with some, do some add-ons, make the growth bigger, and then you're going to sell it down the road for more than what you paid for it, and you're going to get a return. And the returns are not, you know, the same kind of things that VCs are looking. VCs are looking for 10x or even 100x. Private equity guys, you know, much smaller x. It's, you know, you want to return 10, 15% return to your investors, maybe more. That's a good play because these are alternative investments for investors than investing in the stock market. Where venture capitalists, again, they're buying dreams. So it's hard for technology companies today in our space, if they're in a situation where they have to sell their technology because they just got to a situation where they for whatever reason can't continue or don't want to continue.
Ran out of runway.
Yeah, it's you either go to VC and continue to sell the dream and raise more and more money. And a lot of these companies, I believe, are doing that. I don't have detailed financials for some of these groups, but I the valuations that some of the companies are getting, in my mind, so far surpass what they could even conceivably be worth one day. I think it's somewhat staggering.
What are they selling? Are they selling, this is e-discovery is going to be a $20 billion market by 2022, and we currently have all this great momentum and all this great tech, and you know we're the next big thing. Is that the dream that they're selling? Almost like that, even if we get 10% of the $20 billion. Is it that naive?
No, VCs aren't that naive. But I think it's, the first part, I think it's right. It's, look, you know, this is going to be a $20 billion industry, and it's continuing to grow, and we're cutting edge, and we can grow. And, you know, then there's opportunities outside of legal. You know, so it's not you know, most VCs, if you say the market is X and we're going to get 5%, okay, how are you going to get
amateur?
How are you going to execute? So it's not quite that naive, but it's a growing market. And
selling hopes and dreams.
That's it. So I think a technology company is in a distressed technology company or a technology company that can't continue is finding itself, I think, in a difficult situation because private equity doesn't know what to do with it because the company itself has no value because they're losing revenue. And then it's the VC route, which is trying to sell them on the dream. And then but raising money is a full-time job, which is why people need help from people like us, I've experienced this. You know, if you're constantly doing presentations and pitches and responding to document requests and whatnot, it is not only is it extremely time consuming, but it's very difficult from a mental perspective because your brain starts, you start playing tricks with yourself, which is, you know, do I do these three things, but gee, I may sell or these guys may invest or what if they don't invest? And then it becomes a bit
difficult. Yeah, you start thinking about everything differently. You start thinking about personal stuff differently. I can have a bunch of money in 6 months. You start thinking about hiring decisions within the company. You start thinking about, you know, sales differently, short term versus long term. You start thinking about investing in the business differently. And if you go through that cycle for 6 months or a year, or, you know, some of these companies that have had their, you know, they're trying to sell it for multiple years, it's a huge, huge distraction. It feels like, you know, if you try and sell your house and your house is on the market for more than 6 months, two things I think happen. One, people think, why is no one buying this house? That's a problem. But also the homeowner is in that same short-term mentality. You know, they might change a light bulb, but they're not going to really spend the money to do the repairs and the maintenance
like a roof
to be done.
It's not leaking, but you know you're a year away from
it. See if it passes inspection, right?
Like,
see if it passes diligence. And I think that's a very real thing that happens.
Yeah. Well, and I just had a conversation with someone earlier where it's a service company. And again, there's a formula. So right now, service companies are selling to a lot of this sub $10 million e-discovery companies. There's still a very big market from industry consolidation and strategics. So it's a lot of the big boys that you mentioned are still continuing to buy up the little guys. And a lot of the big boys are now backed by private equity. Mm-hmm. So it's not the CEO of the, it's not the guy who originally owned the company. It's now the private equity group that's backing that company. And so it's like going to Daddy Warbucks saying, look, I found a company I want to buy, Daddy. How much can I pay? And there's a formula. It's what are their earnings? Here's, you know, if there's anything proprietary, maybe it's 6X, 7X. If they're big enough, maybe it's 6X. If it's just sort of a meat and potatoes e-discovery company with, you know, little collections, little repro, whatever, you know, maybe it's 3-4X, especially if it's small, but there's a formula and it fits into that formula.
When you start getting into the $50 million companies, which I know there's not a lot left, and here we're talking service again, is that where you're starting to get 10X?
10 on the high.
Because, I mean, Iris sold for like an 11 or a 12 multiple. What was up with that?
If you could answer that question for me, I would love to have an answer. I think people are still scratching their head at that one. And there are clearly outliers.
Okay, so there's not other ones that are like that. That's more
that one was look. I'm. These are all private companies for the most part, so nobody really knows all of the details outside of the people involved in the deals. So a lot of this just becomes anecdotal to some degree. So, you know, I don't know exactly what they sold for. I don't know but the rumor, if there's value to it, that they sold at a multiple that was significantly higher than what we're seeing. And that was also a couple years ago in that frenzy that you talked about. Now it's kind of settled down a little bit and a bit of the frenzy's over. So if you happen to be one of those middle-class companies doing middle-class revenue that we talked about, I think you can get into the 8X range. You know, and especially if you've got proprietary technology or you're doing something differently, there's definitely an argument to be had that, you know, you're 7, 8, 9X, which is more the range that you see for tech companies in our space. And on the smaller side, well, you know, and if you're doing paper, there's very little appetite right now for papers to the point where a lot of the bigger companies don't even value it. It's just an item on the balance.
Because they're going to have to spin it off anyways.
Spin it off, kill it off. Let it ride its course. It's just it's just sort of there. What do you do with it? Some of the groups seem to have more of a tolerance for it than others. I personally kind of feel like paper is a bit like vinyl. It's making a bit of a comeback in a way, because so much of it's gone that the ones that are standing, you know, lawyers still need and like paper. So
they're crushing it. I know a bunch of folks that are running, and they're doubling down on paper because they look around their market and they're like, no one else in Houston is even doing this now.
I think there's a small renaissance to be had. So, yeah.
But it's probably not going to be a huge market, but it does seem like an underserved market at this point.
So yeah, I clearly think it's been right-sized to the point where it's probably been too right-sized.
Right.
But multiples for sort of the bread and butter e-discovery business that's doing under $10 million is in that 4 to 6x range. You know, good people, good clients. You know, certainly clientele is important. Vendors that have corporate relationships, there's a premium for that versus law firm relationships. So I think that's probably been the case for a long time and will continue to be the case. But, you know, I think the holy grail for a vendor is to have a strong corporate client more so than a law firm client. You know, because the weird thing about our industry is, you know, if Bob Jones at Jones Day, that's probably John Doe at Jones Day is your client, you know, is John, it's really John Doe's your client, not Jones Day. In fact, most of the lawyers at Jones Day probably don't even know John Doe, and they probably have no clue that he's using your free discovery. And when he leaves the firm, you're probably going to get his business when he ends up somewhere else. So now Jones Day is no longer your client. So it's not, you know, it's just, I used to tell people that Mayor Brown wasn't a law firm of 500, you know, wasn't a 500 person law firm. It was a law firm of 500 people. And it was almost like 500 different law firms within the firm. And there are pockets of people that work together and know what everybody's doing. But mm-hmm. once you get outside of that very small pocket, there's very little communication amongst the attorneys about what they're doing. Some firms have a centralized lit support person, or e-discovery decisions have to go through centralized people. And those are better clients. You know, certainly than the law firms where it's just sort of the Wild West where anybody can use anybody. But even at the firms where there's a lit support manager, if a senior partner wants to use a vendor, that vendor is going to get used. And if a client tells that law firm, no, you're going to use this vendor because that's the vendor we vetted and that we liked, doesn't matter what kind of relationship you have with that lawyer or that firm, that corporate client's going to win. So the corporate clients are really the holy grail.
Well, and I think it's particularly important from a private equity standpoint that if you have an owner who's trying to exit the business, you know, or there's going to be any sort of turnover that they have to predict post-deal, what effect is that going to have on some of these relationships if three sales reps leave, or if the founder, the CEO, or whatever is the one who's really the one making it rain post-deal, who's going to be in that spot? And I think that that's another thing, right? It has to be contractual. And usually with the corporation, that relationship is stronger. But I think this is where like the managed services deals have gained so much popularity on the vendor side, particularly because isn't that one way that they can prove that that's going to be sticky revenue that's going to be there post-deal?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the you know hosting is a beautiful royalty that comes in every month. But when the case is gone, that royalty ends. So the managed service agreement where, you know, you've got a client and it's X number of dollars per month and includes X number of services and it's a three-year deal, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you raise a good point too, because one of the things that a lot of the larger strategics, you know, one of the first questions that we get when we're representing someone on a sell side is, what do the owners want to do?
Right.
And it's much, generally speaking, it's much more favorably interpreted when, hey, these guys have gas in the tank and they'd like to stick around and they just want to be a part of a bigger group. That goes a lot further than the guy just wants to cash a check and get out. And that's okay. You know, those deals can happen, but you're going to scare some buyers off. And especially if it's in a market where it's difficult for that group to support. So, you know, if the client, if one of the large strategic already has a presence, so, you know, a large presence in that city or that state, and it's knocking out a small player in that space, you may not need
they may as want you much. Gone.
Yeah, they may want you gone, or it's, hey, look, stick around for 6 months or a year, we get it. But if mm-hmm. it's in a, you know, some city or state where they don't have a presence and those relationships go back a ways, it's much more favorable for you know, to think that these people are going to want to stick on.
especially if the group, if it's not a strategic, if it's just a private equity group trying to, you know, enter the market, I imagine they see it much way differently too. They don't have other resources to sort of lean on. There's not a CEO in the wings, or there's not other folks that can step in and run that operation if this is their first or second group, and they're sort of new to the e-discovery market. I would imagine they need all that to stay intact for the long term.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then you also have California, which is a bit of a wild card. So any deal in California is always looked at a little differently than anywhere else, because California has an unenforceable non-compete. Mm-hmm. So you need to look to see who owns those relationships. So for example, if it's, you know, a company doing $5 million and it's like two or three key salespeople that are holding those relationships, that becomes scary for a buyer, because those three people could just leave the next day, and that has happened. I mean, there's some examples where California companies have been bought, and that what they thought they were buying wasn't there after a short period of time because the people left and you couldn't go after them. So those become a little trickier deals as well.
You can lock up the owners with earnouts, but you can't always lock up all the account managers and sales.
That's it. So it's a lot easier to lock people into agreements when it's part of an asset purchase agreement and you're dealing with the sellers and owners of the business. So for example, you know, a 2-year non-compete, a 5-year non-compete, for example, is not going to be enforceable in almost any state. But if it's in the context of an M&A, it's not an employment contract at that point. It's part of a deal, and there's a contract that's separate and apart from that. So that's the way that these guys get locked up, and rightfully so. But if it's a salesperson who has no vested interest in the company and they're just being asked, hey, you need to sign this document. You're not going to get paid by X anymore. You're now going to get paid by Y, and you got to sign a new non-compete or a new agreement, and maybe we'll give you a bonus. Even so, in California, those agreements are just not enforceable if it's with someone who's not an owner of the business. So California deals get a little tricky because of that.
What do you think about the Nuix Ringtail thing? Or have you thought about that at all?
No, I definitely think about it. Again, it's good for M&A. It's more deals good. FTI has been wanting to sell Ringtail for years. That's no small secret.
Yeah.
And I mean, they've been packaging it up and spun it off a couple of years ago. I knew Eddie O'Brien. He was in our Advocate Solutions office in 2000 talking about Ringtail. So, I mean, I've known, he was one of the entrepreneurs back then with a new technology, and had a very small but loyal following, and then did the deal with FTI, and I don't know if they ever really fully knew what to do with it, so they sold it off. No, it'll be interesting to see what Nuix does. They put a very lightly veiled post the day after the deal. If you went to their website, it looked to me like a very interesting shot across the bow to Relativity.
I just went to their user conference, and it was not veiled.
Okay.
It was very direct that they think they're the next big thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I necessarily think they're where they think they are. I think they have a little bit of enthusiasm, which they should. I mean, it's an exciting deal for them, but I think there's a lot of work that they still need to do to kind of put something together.
You know, at the end of the day, it's going to come down. You know, I haven't seen Ringtail in years, so. No one has.
I think that's the problem, right?
Yeah, it's got to work, and people got to like it. So yeah. If people don't, you know, all the marketing and everything behind it's not going to help. But, you know, Nuix has a good following. But again, from an M&A perspective, it's...
The more deals, the more better.
Deals are good. Look, at some point they'll run out, so that's bad, I guess. But there's always new service companies and always new technology companies. You know, M&A is good.
Are there particular areas that you're telling buy-side vendors to, or buy side people to look in, like where there's particular value in the industry?
So I think a lot of the large industry consolidators who are backed by private equity, again, the private equity is looking to make an ROI for their limited partners. And to do that, you buy companies, you make them bigger, you make them more profitable, and then you sell them. So I think a lot of these companies are looking at 2020, you know, to the year 2020 to the year 2025 is sort of like, let's continue to consolidate, let's continue to buy companies, and let's look to flip this to a larger private equity group, or let's get out and our partners will have made money and we'll move on to the next one. That's what these guys do. So for the on the M&A side, again, technology and ways to differentiate fetch higher valuations. So I think a mix of service companies and tech companies, or service companies with proprietary tech, is looked upon very favorably. Some of the larger groups don't want to bring on too much tech and get too far down in big development. You know, some of them, I think, may want to go after Relativity, some may not. But generally speaking, again, a mix of good services, managed services agreements, long-term contracts, good corporate relationships, and tech, and to be able to sort of seamlessly integrate service offerings in a packaged manner is, I think, where the industry is kind of headed. I think, you know, eDiscovery Vendor is a name that's going to be rebranded in the near future. I think it's limiting. You know, I think Managed Review is a big piece, and, you know, collections and all of it. I think the bigger companies want to kind of, you know, kind of like a business process outsourcing in other industries where they, you know, it's, we will come in and manage all of this for you, is where I think the legal industry may be headed. You know, so again, it won't be, hey, we're an eDiscovery vendor. It's, we are a legal process outsourcing vendor that can manage any and all aspects of your legal needs, including legal staffing or legal work, you know, whatnot. I mean, I think what's not even ever being talked about, because it doesn't really, has never really pertained too much to what we do in legal tech, but it'll be interesting to see just even what happens in the practice of law. What impact is AI going to have on the work that young associates going to do? You know, where is that going to be in 2030? I think law firms are continuing to struggle with their revenue models, and how do they continue to bill at the rates that they're billing. You know, you see a lot of consolidation in law firms. You know, what impact is an AVO going to have on the way that law is practiced? I mean, what impact, there's already obviously been a huge impact in the way that outsourced managed review has had on sort of that young lawyer associate work and work from India. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in sort of the traditional law, you know, the law firm side of things, and if there's winds blowing one direction or another and how they impact each other. But I certainly am fascinated to sit back and watch how AI and a lot of the technologies that are being developed today in legal tech are going to start displacing the need for lawyers on the lawyer side. I think that'll be interesting to watch.
You think that's happening, starting to happen, could happen?
Well, it's happening in the sense that there's just more data that can be, the amount of data in some of these lawsuits can't even be reviewed.
Right.
And you have to throw AI at it, or tech. You have to. So yes, I think it's already having an impact.
I was talking to a friend who works for a big company that does, they do a lot of incident response, but they also do they're a big staffing company, and they do a lot of doc review and privilege review. And he was talking about, they're really thinking that, like, even privilege review is a short-term kind of business for them, you know, and the same thing for incident response and like GDPR requests. Mm-hmm. He's like, that's all, there's technology that's out there. Not everybody knows about it yet,
yeah, but
soon they're going to find out. And then that staffing side of his business is, it's not going to be nearly as profitable as it is these days. And so they're acquiring the technology, or they're licensing it, or whatever they need to do to be prepared for that. But, you know, that's just an example from the sort of vendor business staffing side, which isn't quite the same as law firms, but it's the same problem, right? Throwing lawyers at problems.
Well, I think we're either at or nearing a period of time where the technology is changing faster than humans can change to adopt it. Mm-hmm. So there is always a lag between, oh my God, this technology could do all of these things, but it just has yet to be implemented.
Does it feel like the lag is longer in this industry because of, like, legal precedent and because of, you know, challenges to the discovery process from opposing counsel? And do you think that that affects it? Or is this just like, this is how it is in all of the industries, that there's always going to be a lag between technology adoption and the old way of doing things?
Well, we're slow in this industry. I mean, certainly fintech is, you know, everybody's looking for an edge. So they're always looking for how they can use technology for an edge.
Right.
I think medical is slow. Law is slow because lawyers are risk averse and like the status quo. And they're also going to be as resistant to technology that's going to reduce billable hours as they can. So I think for those reasons, you see the adoption of technology in legal as a broad vertical slower than other verticals. And I think that will probably always continue. And it's the pressure from the corporations that are saying, you know, you've got to
do something.
Do something, or, you know, we can't.
Right. Because they're not technology averse, and they're not. You know,
yeah, and as alternative billing mechanisms are sort of imposed downward, law firms are going to have to find ways to be profitable with less overhead. I mean, that. So you are seeing, so for example, I think you walk around any of the really large law firms, they're not occupying nearly the amount of real estate that they once were. Mm. So, you know, they're already trying to find ways to reduce it overhead, and that will continue. And, you know, I've heard of a friend of mine opines that you're going to start seeing the big accounting firms and the big consulting firms starting to provide legal services and legal work and a lot of this stuff. And what you know, those are pretty entrenched relationships, you know, from all the accounting stuff. Hmm. And if they start offering legal services, what does that mean for the big law firms? So it's kind of interesting.
It's very interesting. Well, thanks for taking the time to do this. It's so, in 1 hour, however long, we went from printing out pieces of paper, you know, putting stickers on them and then scanning them back in en masse to cyber investigations and due diligence. So
yeah,
it's quite a span of time in the industry. I mean, it's evolving and it's evolving quick. That's I think the funnest part of business in general, but
yeah, well, and I'm having a lot of fun being involved at the M&A side where I'm still completely immersed in it, but I don't have to talk about load files.
<That's right>. I want to be you. I want to be you. All right, man, we'll leave it there. Thanks. You.
All right. Thank you so much, Rick, man. I learned a ton and I really enjoyed talking to him. So hopefully you guys like this too. I put a little bit here at the end of some of our earlier conversation that I had cut out initially, but he had asked me a little bit about the podcast and our statistics and kind of, you know, how many listeners we have and stuff. So I thought I might include this here at the end. Before I get to that, just a quick reminder, I'm going to actually do a write-up of this episode, kind of a business side of eDiscovery and M&A and all of that stuff. If you're just listening to the podcast, you might want to check out the Oasis blog so you can kind of read my summary and my takeaways from this. And I think that's it.
You must have metrics around sort of the number of people that listen or download or whatever.
Yeah, it's usually between 100 and 200 on the first day. And then the long tail is, you know, between 300 and 800 listeners, depending on the podcast. So, like, Seja, you know, Judge Peck, the guy who runs eDiscovery, Uber, like, those are all, like, 1,000 views or downloads. But, you know, just the average ones are usually a few hundred.
That's cool. That's awesome.
Which I thought was pretty decent. Like when I started it, I just started on a lark and I said, okay, I'm going to do 10 episodes. I promised myself I'm going to do 10 interviews, mostly because I wanted to learn how to interview. And I like this stuff. I like one of the gadgets and cool. All that that's stuff. Cool. And then I said, if I can get 50 listeners, I'll keep it going.
So how are you awesome. Even getting the word out that this thing is even out there?
I don't try.
You should.
I know, but listen, I run a company. Like you run a company. Like that's my bread and butter. That's
no, but you've done this. You want people listening. It's not going to.
I do.
It's not going to take anything to have like you know Andrew at Relativity Fest do a shout out or have a.
I know. I post it on LinkedIn. Usually when I interview somebody, you know, they'll post it on their blog.
Yeah,
something like Socia or one of those guys. Like they'll get it around a little bit.
Okay, that's it. Have a great day.